So Rafael is going to be talking about Rust in Mercurial. So please give him a welcome.
Hello, everyone. Thank you. I'm going to do one clap because my last talk was out of sync. Thank you. Welcome. I'm going to be talking about the usage of Rust within Mercurial, why we think using Rust is the right choice for us, and why some of the lessons that you might take away from this in your projects. My name is Rafael Gomez. I work at a small company called Octobus. We're a consulting company, and we specialize in version control, and specifically on Mercurial. It is version control software. It happened at the same time as Git. It was created then in 2005, written at the time in Python with a little bit of C. And for this room, it's had Rust extensions since 2018 and a pure Rust FastPath since 2020. I actually gave a presentation on that FastPath in 2020 here. Since then, the amount of Rust that we've had in our code base has grown steadily. This is based off of lines of code, so it's not really the best metric ever, but it gives you a rough idea that Rust is now a pretty significant part of Mercurial. So this is around 500,000 lines of code all included. The C bits have basically not moved that much in the past 10 years, aside from some compatibility stuff, and Rust has kept growing. A version control system is kind of a weird database. I'm going to talk a little bit about the constraints within the project and why we think that Rust is a good fit, specifically because we do stuff that is highly specialized to the data that we are handling. One example of that is Mercurial's manifest. The manifest is a data structure that for each revision, for each commit, it holds the entire list of every file that this revision has. It's similar to a Git tree. The manifest has a compression ratio of up to 50,000 times. If you have a very, very large repository, some private stuff, and for example, the Mozilla one, it stores about 1 petabyte of completely uncompressed data in about 20 gigabytes of actual on disk. We have a plan for a zero copy version that has the exact same characteristics, meaning that we have a 50,000 times compression ratio, but we don't even have to allocate or do anything to handle with it. This is a proof of concept, but the current implementation already has that property. Mercurial scales comfortably. We have another example of a large private repository. It has tens of millions of change sets, millions of files, everything fully replicated using vanilla Mercurial, and it's working fine. So those are kind of the scaling and the performance aspects of it. But why do we use Rust specifically for those on-disk data structures? Why couldn't we use Python? Because it turns out that Python isn't really great for binary access. Quick show of hands, who has heard about the struct module of Python? Decent fifth of the room, I would say. The struct module allows you to do unpacking and packing of binary data. This is an example of a node in one of our formats. And this means like you have a big endian of something that has 2 bytes, then four, whatever. So you define your format, and what that gives you is a way of unpacking and packing binary data. So this example is for what I've just showed you is for a data structure called the dir state that corresponds to the working copy. This means whatever you're working on, your files, your folders, in your currently checked out revision. This is a zero copy persistent tree, and it's useless in Python. It was written with Rust in mind because something like this would not have been possible or practical, because we have a Python implementation, but it's not practical for scaling with Python. So I'm getting back to this specific example. This creates a 13-tuple, for each node, we have millions of them, or at least hundreds of thousands of them, 14 objects per node. That means if you want to do anything with any amount of encapsulation and for your code to be somewhat usable, you will probably have a class instance per node. Every node you would put into a recursive disk, a dict, sorry, which because you need parent and child relations, etc. That means a lot of allocation, that means garbage collection. So using such a data structure is not practical using Python. But what about the C extensions, you might say? Maybe not in this room that much, but historically it's interesting to understand what happens. Cross-platform, cross-OS work is harder because you have to do more manual things that you would in Python, which is pretty good at cross-platform compatibility. At some point, you will still need to interact with the huge Python code base that we have. So it means that your limits have to go up into a higher level abstraction, and you have to write that in C. And it turns out that a C rewrite is pretty much out of the question because contributors have felt uneasy in general writing high-level logic in C. And this is not to say that we haven't had very competent C programmers within the project. The creator of the project herself, Olivia Makel, did a whole bunch of stuff in the Linux kernel, and she was, and still is probably, a very competent C programmer. But she said at the initial phase of Mercurial in 2005 and 6 that she chose Python because she was able to do things in 2 weeks that would have taken her month in C, and so she would just not have done it. So for us, we've established that data access is fundamental. And this is where Rust really fits into the picture. Rust helps us build on top of the data access, which is the most crucial part for us. This is generally my problem. We have a giant code base, and what my head is able to fit all at once and that I can keep inside of my context is actually a pretty small part of the code base. Maybe that's a me problem. I think that's a general problem for most people. There's no way that you can have the entire code base in context, which means that you need your tooling to help you do local reasoning, thinking about your code locally. And to some extent, this is not specifically particular to Rust. You could be using another programming language like OCaml or whatever else programming language that has a strong enough type system that it can enforce invariance of whatever you're trying to build and say, this state is not possible, and it's not possible at compile time, and it helps you like define all of those rules. But you may have heard about something very specific to Rust that is the borrow checker for aliasing and parallelization. This also, like, it's a layer on top of the type system, and the type system is built in a quite careful way, picking out things that other languages have done and doing a very good mix of a whole bunch of very old ideas and some a little bit newer, and one specific novel idea, which is the borrow checker, which allows you to think very locally. I can look at a diff during code review, and I can say, oh, you're touching this line or using this particular struct, and it's very easy to understand the implications without having to get the entire code base within your head, or at least the entire space within that code base. For me, that means that refactoring is easier. It means that code review is much easier, especially for complex systems. I'm not talking about small scripts, I'm really talking about larger projects. And this is kind of the bonus. Profiling and tracing is easier, much easier than Python. I don't think Rust has any advantage over all other compile times, though the tracing ecosystem is actually quite nice. And if any of you have contributed to tracing, thanks. So let's talk about the ecosystem. Well, Rust helps you, like the language helps you, but the ecosystem is kind of linked together with its ecosystem. Cargo was built after many other projects have tried and different ideas of how do you build a package manager. Those projects maybe started when like access to the internet was not a given, for example, or the way that you would distribute libraries is by, you know, sending them via email or tarballs or whatever. It was a very different time. Cargo had the luxury of building itself on top of the corpses of other package managers, some of which are not are still alive somehow. And thankfully, this helps us get a whole bunch of problems out of the way. It has quite good features, like yanking. Does anybody not know what yanking is in the context of cargo? Okay, two people. That's cool. So yanking means you have a bad version of a crate that you've published, and you want to remove that and say, please don't install this crate. It's not a please, it's like, don't install this crate. It has some problem, some security issue, whatever. And so cargo, by default, will not pull a yanked crate and will refuse to install it unless you specifically do something with the log file. Speaking of, you have a log file, which allows you to pin your dependencies, and which now we take for granted. And everybody's like, yeah, of course you have a log file. But that really was not clear not that long ago. Also, in general, and that might just, I mean, everything is my opinion, but this is maybe even more my opinion. I think, in general, the ecosystem is of higher quality than most of others that I've seen. Part of that is that it's a newer language, it's a newer ecosystem, so all of the individual libraries and projects can build on top of the mistakes that others have made, so it's an easier thing. But also, I feel like there's a shift. Whenever you write something that you want to publish in the Rust world, the first question that everybody's going to ask is it blazingly fast and blah, blah, blah. And so you have some amount of pressure to build something that follows the latest research trends, that has a nice API, et cetera. There's more scrutiny, so I think the ecosystem in general has higher quality. So when, for example, we've improved the way that we do diffing in Mercurial, we just took a random diffing library and it just worked, and we didn't have to think too hard about it because its performance characteristics were just fine. And that's, I think, pretty nice. In general, the ecosystem is focused on performance, which for us is very important, but that's not the only reason. I want to give a quick shout out to diff.rs. Who knows about this website? Okay, wow. It's a very simple idea. You can do diffing across crate versions. So you can just say, oh, I want to update my dependencies, which I do every start of a cycle. What is the actual source code difference between the crates that have been published? This is, for me, very useful to vet that the dependencies are doing what they say they are doing on the tin. I think in a more general sense, Rust has changed the way that we act on the project. There were many times in the Mercurial project where certain solutions were not pursued because the implementation was too scary or the model didn't fit the reality. And because basically, whenever you wanted to do something in Python, you had to say, yeah, but I it has to go into a dict after that, so it kind of like misses the point. People didn't want to write complex C stuff. So using Rust means that we are now not scared of advanced ideas for complex problems. Some of the problems that we have an inherent complexity that you cannot reduce the problem further. It's just complex in itself. And so having a simple solution is nice, but sometimes there is no actual simple solution. You have to have a solution that matches the complexity of the problem. And before that, it was not as obvious for us in that sense. And Rust enables us to simply think about the problem and say, this is possible. An example of that. Seven something years ago, there was a contributor who talked about on the mailing list about a proof of concept that they had done to speed up the status command. When you say, what are the changes on my working copy? What are the files that have changed, etc. Because status was slow, and they say, oh, I have a pure Rust version, and it goes some number of tens of milliseconds for some number of files. I don't exactly remember, but I remember that someone told them, oh, this performance is impossible. It was somebody quite high up at a large company who said, no, this is not possible, even though they had access to the code and could test it themselves. And what happened is we upstreamed that, or a better version of that, that was actually four times faster than the proof of concept, meaning that we ended up with something, if you have a pretty beefy machine, you can do 100 milliseconds of status for about 1 million files, which is as fast as we can get, like, to do anything in Python, plus, you know, the very small amount of modules that we import. By that point, we've already lost, and we've done the status for 1 million files on the exact same machine. This is about 100 milliseconds for both. By the way, this is all without FS monitor. It's all in process. It's just pure like Buddha Rust, like exec Rust program. Do the status, give back the answer, close the status. This is all done in 100 milliseconds. Some of you may have heard this expression, fall into the pit of success. Look at how happy they are. For those of you who may not be familiar, falling into the pit of success means that if you have a well-designed system, it's easy to do the right things, and it's annoying to do the wrong things. And I think somehow Rust, its ecosystem, helps us fall a little bit more into the pit of success. So let me recap. Why Rust? Optimal data structures and optimal algorithms. This means that we can go from a research paper, which we do work on, like research papers with people whose entire job is graph theory and that kind of stuff, go from the model of the research paper and say, I know how to implement it, and I'm not scared of doing that, and then maintaining that afterwards. Because it's not just a matter of writing some fancy stuff so you can brag about it at FOSDEM. It's also because you know that you've been maintaining 20 years of code, and that you will likely be maintaining it for another 20. And that is not scary anymore because of all of what Rust has that is unique, in that it's aligning a whole bunch of features that are good in many languages in a very nice way, and it's also providing some of its own specificity. This means that it's unlocking previously impractical designs. That's kind of what I've been talking about this whole time. And maybe, you know, there's the fact that if you build a higher quality code base and a higher quality project, then it kind of pushes you in the way that everything else has to become higher quality as well. Sometimes we've rewritten stuff to prepare for a Rust extensions, and the Python got a lot better because the architecture was better, and nobody had ever really looked at it because everybody was like, oh, it's Python, it's slow. Not always. Python can be decently fast if you have the right data and doing the right things. It's just it shifted the mentality for the entire project. And in general, I think our contributors prefer Rust over Python. Not all of them, mind you, but the people that are thinking hard about the problems that make Mercurial scale, that make it move into the next generation of version control, prefer to do it in Python, in Rust, and not in Python and C written by kernel developers 20 years ago, somehow. So yeah, I think this is it for me. Thank you, and feel free to come talk to me after this. I'm assuming they're speechless.
sorry. What does interfacing between Python and Rust look like in the code base?
Sorry, could you speak up? Like it's all shooting this way.
What does it look like interfacing between the Python and the Rust? Because one of the problems that you mentioned with C is that you've still got this sort of translation between the data structures and what you see in Python. So how are you sort of eliminating that class of problems using Rust?
Yeah. So one part of the problem is how hard is it to write FFI code, like the glue code? And it's easier thanks to the ecosystem, like PyO3. We were using Rusty Python first, and then we moved to PyO3 when it was when it fit our needs. It helps doing that a lot easier. But also, what I was saying is that at some point you need to move like one layer up. For the status work, I actually started doing the status in Rust, but there was a lot of back and forth, like one back and forth per file, and that was absolutely not scalable. So you kind of have to raise the bar, and that's the only way that you can do it in a performant manner. There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So you talked about RHG status going super fast. So the code in Rust, is it vertical command by command, or is it doing horizontal, if you were to draw it out maybe, where it's doing the file system stuff and then the Python builds on top of it?
Stuff specifically does not start Python. This is pure Rust.
Yeah, but when you have the, I think it was about 15% Rust in the project.
Yes.
Was it like horizontal layers, or was it command by command?
Yes. So we have like kind of two different bits of Rust in the project. One of them is the pure Rust version, which is kind of on its own tree, on its own side. It's independent from the Python side, and it plugs into a shared library, which is then hooked into Python. So some of that is used both as just Python extensions that look like normal Python, except that they're written in Rust, and other stuff is completely pure Rust. So for status, we both have a Python version that calls into the status and comes back with an answer, and a pure Rust version that uses the same code.
Okay.
There you go.
Great. Thanks. Anyone else? No?
Yeah, one question here.
Great.
Will the Rust version become the default one for status, for example, or what is the path for making that?
I didn't catch the very first part.
Will the RHG status become default at some point, or how do you do that?
The point right now is RHG is transparent. You can, like, it looks like HG, and if it doesn't know how to do something, it will fall back to HG. So it's kind of like you don't have to ask the user to migrate. But at some point, we will have to build like a new way of interacting with Mercurial that is not the AG command line. But that was very much out of scope for this talk, yes.
If there's no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.